Georgia's high-stakes Senate runoff is over, but the GOP blame game is just getting started. Republicans are pointing fingers, and mostly in the direction of Donald J. Trump. Plus, the former president's legal team reveals more classified documents have turned up, and they were found in a storage facility. We'll tell you more about that, and also ahead, Russian President Vladimir Putin warns that the war in Ukraine could go on for a long time. We'll have expert analysis about what that could mean for continued aid to Ukraine from the U.S. and other allies. Good morning and welcome to Way Too Early on this Thursday, December 8th. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for starting your day with us. We're going to begin this morning with a dramatic new revelation involving classified items and former President Donald Trump. Two more documents with classified markings were discovered at a Florida storage facility not far from Trump's Mar-a-Lago home and club following a search carried out at the direction of Trump's own attorneys. That's according to two people familiar with the documents who spoke to NBC News. They say the documents were turned over to the FBI, confirming a report first published in the Washington Post. But the nature of the documents were not immediately revealed. The discovery comes nearly 4 months after FBI agents executed a search warrant at Mar-a-Lago and found more than 100 documents with classified markings, including some that were labeled top secret. The storage unit where the new documents were discovered is in West Palm Beach, Florida, not far from Mar-a-Lago, and is run by the General Services Administration. One of the sources said that Trump has actually never been inside that storage facility. The New York Times reports the discovery came after Trump's lawyers hired an outside firm to conduct a series of wider searches that were completed around Thanksgiving at Trump properties. Those properties include Trump's golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, Trump Tower in New York, and a storage closet at Mar-a-Lago itself. The discovery of the new documents is further evidence that Trump and his team did not fully comply with a grand jury subpoena issued back in May that sought all documents marked classified still in their possession. The FBI yesterday declined to comment. The Justice Department has been conducting what it's described as an active criminal investigation into whether the White House documents at Mar-a-Lago were mishandled, as well as possible obstruction of justice. With the midterm elections officially in the rearview mirror, finger-pointing over the Republican Party's disappointing results has reached a new level. Speaking yesterday, a number of GOP lawmakers directly blamed former President Trump for their party's shortcomings. Take a look.
President Trump lost again, and I know a lot of people in our party love the president, former president, but he's, if you will, the kiss of death for somebody who wants to win a general election.
I think his obsession with the 2020 election became an albatross and a real liability for, you know, people who are running, especially in swing states.
I think he's less relevant all the time. Again, even if you capture all of the Trump voters, you may be able to win a primary, but you're not necessarily going to win a general election.
Those candidates most closely associated with former President Trump underperformed. That is objective. And those who had a little bit more distance tended to do a little bit better.
But not all Republicans were ready to blame Trump for the losses. Some yesterday blamed the party's inability to earn more mail-in and early votes, while ignoring the fact that Trump, of course, has been the one spending years dissuading Republicans from using those particular voting methods.
Is former President Trump's endorsement the kiss of death, as another Republican senator said today?
One thing Democrats have done a good job. They got their mail-in. They did a better job with early votes, mail-in and early voting. I think people vote based on what they think is important to them. They don't vote because one of us tells them they should vote that way.
Well, I don't think this was any referendum on President Trump. I think this is a referendum on us learning the cycle of how to run an election. We as Republicans have to learn about getting people out to vote. Cat's out of the bag with early voting.
Donald Trump's presence was so significant here. Republicans are ready to embrace him in 2024 as their standard bearer.
I don't quite see it that way. The Trump factor helps some and it hurts some, depending where you're at. Biden's not overly popular, but they won. because I think their financing system is so much better than ours.
In a not particularly surprising development, the former president was pushing all the blame off Herschel Walker's loss away from himself yesterday, writing on his social media platform this: 232 out of 252 midterm races won who had my endorsement. The real reasons were other than Trump, and I could name them all. Although most of Trump's endorsees did win, many of them were incumbents and already favorites in their races, many in deeply red districts. And according to the Cook Political Report, all five candidates he endorsed within the 36 most competitive House races lost. And five of his six endorsees in key Senate races also lost. And as Republicans struggle to figure out why they never got a red wave, Democrats in the Senate are celebrating their history-defying midterms. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee Chairman Senator Gary Peters of Michigan explained yesterday what they believe made the difference.
In May and June, the public began to realize how far right these MAGA Republicans had gone. The Dobbs decision was the crystallization of that, of course, when people said, wow, these MAGA Republicans are serious about turning the clock all the way back.
The contrast between them and their opponents was extreme. And one of the most powerful issues for us was the choice issue. The abortion issue was clearly a motivating factor for our base in all of our states. It got people out.
And the turning point really occurred that summer, this summer, where we passed six major bills, five bipartisan, all of which affected people's lives. They were the things people wanted us to talk about. Making the environment better, dealing with the high cost of prescription drugs, helping our veterans who were unduly hewn, dealing with gun safety, getting American jobs here, not in China, with new industries in the CHIPS legislation. Expanding health care. And they said, whoa, this Democratic Party is the party that I like.
Schumer greeted Democrats' 51st Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia as Warnock returned to Washington yesterday. Here is the majority leader on why that extra seat is so important in the upper chamber.
The practical effects of the 51-seat majority, it's big, it's significant. It gives us a breathe. We can breathe a sigh of relief. Obviously, judges and nominees will be a lot easier to put on the bench. So the bench is looking more like America. Now it's going to be easier. So are the nominees. It's been amazing how Republicans have been able to use the 50-50 Senate to procedurally hold up so many appointments. It's going to be a lot quicker, swifter, and easier. It's going to mean that our committees will have greater oversight ability, subpoena power. And people say, well, it's the Biden administration. Oh, no. Subpoena power can deal with corporate corruption and inequities and other problems throughout the country.
Chuck Schumer deserves a lot of credit, and so does Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee Chairman Senator Gary Peters of Michigan, who will join the conversation later on Morning Joe. Joining us now is Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News and MSNBC, Ali Raffa. Good morning, Ali. Thanks for being with us this morning. A tale of two parties. Let's start with the Republicans. A relatively large number of GOP senators were willing to name former President Trump as at least a factor in Herschel Walker's defeat in Georgia. Talking to folks there on the Hill, what's the sense among Republicans? Are they think this could be an inflection point when they might be starting to be ready to move on from Trump? Or do they think that the party is still very much in his grasp?
I think that is the case, Jonathan. Good morning. Yeah, we saw just even before the midterms, Republicans were starting to distance themselves from Trump. We saw the impact that had in the midterm elections in his announcement for a 2024 bid for the presidency. He was largely considered to be the Republican kingmaker. And now we're starting to see example after example of Republicans distancing themselves from him, not just after the midterms because of these midterm losses, but because of the extremist comments and behavior we've seen over the past few weeks from the former president. And Republicans are now doing an audit of what happened, what went wrong, and why, especially in Georgia. They're wondering you know, why Trump, knowing how critical and key of a Senate race we knew Georgia to always be, why would he enthusiastically back Herschel Walker, knowing how flawed of a candidate he was? And you saw, you mentioned that finger pointing there. We saw John Thune unequivocally blamed Trump and his claims that the 2020 election was stolen as a reason for that loss in Georgia. We also saw Senator Lindsey Graham, who is still a strong ally of former President Trump, not exactly blame him by name, but say that it's because of a poor candidate because of that loss in Georgia. So you're seeing the blame game go around, whether it's blaming Trump directly, blaming, as you said, lack of mail-in voting, lack of voter turnout efforts. And so there's definitely a difference in opinion of what happened in Georgia. But there is a pattern here that we're seeing Republicans need to unify over the next 2 years, and they're still struggling in doing so.
Trump's effort to poison the water over mail-in voting is one that many Republicans truly regret. But on the Democratic side, woo, we literally see it. Celebrations, high fives, and hugs, including one from Schumer to Raphael Warnock yesterday. And let's talk about Georgia's senator, reelected now to a full six-year term. A lot of buzz about he is now a rising star within the Democratic Party. What did his future look like in Washington?
Yeah, there were even reports when Senator Raphael Warnock landed in D.C. yesterday. There were cheers just at Reagan Airport when he landed at the airport. You saw Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer greet him at the Capitol when he arrived yesterday. And Democrats know how much this extra seat is going to help them for at least the next 2 years, because the big drama on Capitol Hill for the past 2 years has been about where Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin stand on things, because Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer knew he needed their support to get anything done. That's technically not the case anymore. These Democrats can afford to lose one vote and still get key legislation passed. It gives them more power, as you heard Schumer say at this press conference yesterday, over subpoenas, over committees. It won't require Vice President Kamala Harris to come in as that critical tie-breaking vote as often. The caveat here is that, you know, whatever passes in the Senate also has to pass in the House. The House, of course, as we know, going to be headed by Republicans come January when they're sworn in, Jonathan.
NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Ali Raffa, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And still ahead here on Way Too Early, what we're learning about the timing of the January 6th committee's final report. Plus, Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning that the war in Ukraine could be a very long process. We're going to talk about that with retired four-star Navy Admiral James Stavridis. Those stories, a check on the weather, and a very depressing sports item when we come right back.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day. Each morning in your inbox with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Welcome back. We're learning new details about the timing of the House Select Committee's final report on the January 6th Capitol attack. Chairman Benny Thompson has confirmed the panel plans to release the report on December 21st. That's also when the committee will vote on any criminal referrals.
It'll be a formal presentation. We haven't decided exactly what.
Would the criminal referral vote also be public?
Yes.
Yes.
So it could all be done in one day?
Yes. Actually, the 21st.
The committee could also offer contempt of Congress referrals for anyone who ignored the panel's subpoenas. The referrals don't carry any legal weight, but serve as recommendations. Meanwhile, House lawmakers are expected to vote on the Respect for Marriage Act this morning, which would recognize same-sex marriage on the federal level. The House previously passed the bill in July on a 267-157 vote. Lawmakers have to vote on the bill again to address changes to the legislation that were made in the Senate. In addition, the House is expected to vote tomorrow on the National Defense Authorization Act, which they need to do every year. As we've been reporting, the U.S. could face what is being dubbed as a triple-demic this winter, as cases of COVID-19, the flu, and RSV continue to surge. NBC News correspondent Tom Costello has the details.
Early December, and hospitals nationwide are once again at full capacity with a trifecta of illness: COVID, the RSV virus, and a flu season that started 6 weeks early. Flu hospitalizations now running at a decade high, with 79% of hospital beds occupied.
We need people to be sure to stay home when you're sick.
Nationwide, at least 4,500 flu deaths just since October 1st. Why the surge? Infectious disease experts say after several years of pandemic isolation, most Americans are back at school, work, gathering indoors with others, and traveling. Some exposed to viruses for the first time in 2+ years.
Our immune systems are just fine. They were ready and waiting. They just hadn't been exposed to the virus. This has been an exposure deficit.
So much flu, some pharmacies are running low on flu medication.
This is Jeremiah. This is my rainbow baby.
In Kansas City, Bailey Keel is still mourning the 7-week-old daughter she lost last year to RSV. Last week, her newborn Jeremiah was admitted to the hospital after he, too, got sick.
I had nothing but anxiety. I didn't know if, you know, I was going to be having lose another child or if I was going to be able to keep him with me. So it was absolutely scary.
The CDC and frontline doctors are urging both adults and children to quickly get a flu vaccine and a COVID booster.
Americans are treating this holiday season, many of them turning the page, but we need to be careful. Cases are surging. Still ahead, highlights from last night's action in the NBA. Plus, we're tracking the latest free agent moves in Major League Baseball, including one that bums me out. We'll be right back with that.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
So it's asking.
Oh, ball's down. Picked up. Beasley with a chance. Inside. Yes! Fontecchio! Off the steal by Utah. It's over.
Wow.
It's over. The Jazz beat the world champions.
The Utah Jazz steal the game from the Golden State Warriors, forcing that turnover and scoring the go-ahead basket with less than 2 seconds remaining. Jazz win 124-123. The Warriors just don't seem right, at least so far in the NBA season. To Phoenix now, and a showdown between the top teams in each conference. Well, it turned into a beatdown by the Boston Celtics. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown each scored 25 points. Malcolm Brogdon added 16 off the bench. And the Celts improved their NBA best record to 21-5 with an easy 125-98 win over the Phoenix Suns. In Brooklyn, Nets guard Kyrie Irving made a statement on his sneakers during last night's win over the Charlotte Hornets. One day after his official split with Nike, the controversial star used what looked like black tape to cover the swoosh emblem on his shoes, and in that space had the words, quote, "I am free," written in gold marker. The other side read, "Logo here." Irving's partnership with the sportswear giant was severed in the aftermath of his promotion of an anti-Semitic movie on Twitter. Now to another big day of free agent signings in Major League Baseball. As we told you yesterday on Morning Joe, as news broke live on the show, the reigning AL MVP, Aaron Judge, is sticking with the franchise that drafted and developed him, rejoining the New York Yankees on a reported 9-year deal worth $360 million. The last years of that contract could be an albatross, but Yankees did what they had to do. You keep your star, you keep the face of the franchise. The story, not the same in Boston. Longtime Red Sox shortstop Xander Bogaerts, who had played all 10 of his MLB seasons at Fenway, has reportedly reached an 11-year, $280 million agreement to join the San Diego Padres. 11 years, probably too much for Xander, but it should never have gotten this to this point. The Red Sox lowballed him with an extension offer in the spring. Another superstar following Mookie Betts out the door. Team leader, unofficial team captain, World Series champion, now gone. Red Sox facing real fan backlash in New England. Sox did, meanwhile, reportedly ink a deal with the best bat coming over from Japan, adding outfielder Masataka Yoshida on a reported 5-year, $90 million contract. Maybe that's a nice move. It will not make up for the anger over losing Xander Bogaerts. They better re-sign Rafi Devers ASAP. Finally, we're going to go to the NHL and Columbus, Ohio, where Buffalo Sabres forward Tage Thompson matched a franchise record with 5 goals. Yep, 5 goals in last night's 9-4 win over the Blue Jackets. Thompson's 5 goals marks the second most ever scored in an NHL road game. He put in 4 in the first period. I guess he slacked off the rest of the game. Time now for weather, and let's go to meteorologist Michelle Grossman for the forecast. Michelle, I can tell you it's gloomy in New England. Otherwise, how's it looking?
Gloomy in many ways, right? We're looking at a couple problem areas today. Rain falling in the Tennessee Valley, the Southern Plains, and it's heavy in some spots where you see those brighter colors. It's been raining for days there. It's going to continue to rain, and we're going to see some thunderstorms as well. You can notice on the backside a little pink and blue showing up. That's some colder air working in, so we do have the chance for some wintry weather in portions of the Midwest, even encroaching on the Ohio Valley. So for today, we remain unsettled in the east. We could see a few showers forming in the Mid-Atlantic as well later on today. Anywhere from a quarter inch to a half inch up to 1 inch of rain is possible. It's really warm too. Temperatures 10 to 20 degrees above average in the south. It's 82 degrees. It'll be 82 degrees today in Houston. That could tie or break a record of 83 if we get above that. 82 in Mobile, 82 in Tallahassee. Another really warm day tomorrow with temperatures in the 70s and 80s. 79 in Lake Charles. Jonathan?
Michelle Grossman, thank you as always. Still ahead here on Way Too Early, the Supreme Court hears arguments on a hugely important case that could allow state legislatures to bypass courts when it comes to election results. We're going to talk to a reporter who's been closely following that story. We'll be right back with that. Welcome back to Way Too Early. It's 5:30 a.m. on the East Coast, 2:30 out West. I'm Jonathan Lemire. Thanks for being with us. The Supreme Court heard nearly 3 hours of arguments yesterday in a case concerning the role and power that state legislatures have when it comes to regulating elections. The case concerns North Carolina's Republican state legislature and its redrawn congressional map that heavily favored the GOP. The state Supreme Court blocked the map in February and issued a court-drawn one. North Carolina Republicans asked the U.S. Supreme Court to then block the court-drawn map, which it denied, instead setting up this week's oral arguments. The court-drawn maps were used in this year's midterms. And joining us now to talk about it, state politics reporter for Politico, Zach Montalaro, who has been following this case all along. Zach, thanks so much for being here this morning. So break down what we heard yesterday and give us a summary of how each side presented their case.
Yes, what we heard yesterday was a very, very long argument. But really, what it really boiled down to was Republican legislators in North Carolina trying to advance something called the independent state legislature theory, which is, as you said, trying to argue that state legislatures have really unchecked power within their states to make election laws, be it redistricting or broader. Think about voter ID laws, things like that. The conversations around do state courts get to serve as a check on that? And we heard a largely skeptical Supreme Court. There was a couple of proponents of it, the most conservative, probably Justice Gorsuch and Justice Alito and Thomas. But that middle block of conservative justices be it Justice Roberts in particular, kind of sounded very hesitant to adapt that theory. And that is where we're going in the next couple months as they craft this decision, is where do those three middle justices land?
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to go with you next. I mean, so if right now, if where are the tea leaves? Read them for us. Do we think this probably, if the middle, those moderate conservatives, the Roberts ilk of the court, are opposed to this, does this go down to defeat?
So it depends what you define as defeat, right? There's still a universe where the North Carolina map drawn by the courts there gets thrown out. But I don't think, at least at this point, that we're heading towards that most muscular version of the state legislature theory. That seems out the door. Is there a middle ground that still preserves some level of state judicial review, but has the Supreme Court acting as a higher check in, you know, the most egregious cases? Maybe that might be where we're heading. But that biggest theory that cuts out state Supreme Court review at all, that looks to be off the table.
Right? And as a final question, let's take a step back and really just sum up the stakes here. Some have suggested this is one of the most important cases about democracy that the Supreme Court has heard in generations. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, if they took that more muscular review that really cut out that state Supreme Court, yes. Preserving some level of review for the state Supreme Courts, for state judiciary at large, probably makes it a less important case, but the potential was certainly there to kind of cut that out.
All right. Well, we'll be following this, obviously, in the weeks ahead. We really appreciate you coming in this morning. Politico's Zach Ballantyllero, thank you so much for being here this morning. And still ahead here on Way Too Early, we're going to go live to CNBC for an early look at what's driving the markets this morning following a fifth straight day of losses on Wall Street. Plus, the United Arab Emirates now boasts the world's best passport. We'll explain why. We'll be right back. Time now for business. And for that, let's bring in CNBC's Juliana Tattelbaum, who joins us live from London there. Juliana, good morning. Investors today are continuing to assess the possibility of an economic recession, it would appear, following a fifth straight day of losses for the S&P 500. What's the early sense as to how the market is shaping up this morning?
Well, John, you've exactly captured the mood in markets right now. There are a lot more jitters around the outlook for the U.S. economy and a lot more investors concerned that a recession could be on the horizon and that the Fed may struggle to nail that soft landing where they're able to raise rates, but not so much or so fast that they cripple the U.S. economy. As for trade today, U.S. futures have been bouncing around. As you can see on your screens there, right now, all three of the major indices are pointing to a modestly positive start. You mentioned yesterday's performance. It was the fifth straight day of losses for the S&P, and eight in the last nine have been negative. So it's been a difficult run. All of this ahead of a bumper calendar next week in terms of central bank action. We've got the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, and a new U.S. inflation report all to play for.
Yeah, speaking to White House officials yesterday, they're all already nervously awaiting some of those numbers next week. On another topic, Juul has reached a settlement covering thousands of lawsuits over its vaping products. Tell us about it.
This has been a huge uncertainty for Juul Labs. And the news here, the company has reached a legal settlement covering more than 5,000 lawsuits and 10,000 individuals. There's no amount disclosed around the actual amount that they settled for. But we do know that the company has obtained equity investment in order to fund it. Now, if you have been tracking this story, you'll know that a few years ago, Juul really became this teen symbol for what was cool and sleek, and these vaporizers surged in terms of sales. And the co-lead counsel for plaintiffs in this litigation came out with a statement saying that these settlements will put meaningful compensation in the hands of victims and their families. The company's cigarettes were briefly banned back in June, but then following an appeal, the FDA put that ban on hold and agreed to a further review. So the jury is still out as to what the ultimate future looks like for these e-cigarettes.
And then we teased it as we just went to break. The United Arab Emirates now has what is considered the world's most powerful passport. How is one passport more powerful than another? Juliana, tell us what this means.
Well, I think this will come as a surprise to many. A lot of people look at EU countries, for example, European Union countries like Germany, France, Spain, and think those passports must be really valuable. Well, no. According to this new list, if you are an Emirati passport holder, you are one of the lucky ones. You can travel to a huge number of countries without visas, and that is one of the key elements of this ranking. And in many others, you can get a visa right when you arrive. Emirati passport holders can enter 121 countries, to be exact, without a visa, and then a further 59 states you can get a visa upon arrival. So ultimately, a good passport is defined by how easily you can travel with it. And the UAE passport is a pretty good one to hold.
All right. Well, good to know. And I, for one, would like to do some traveling. We could all use some time off. CNBC's Juliana Tadelbaum live from London. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Still ahead here on Way Too Early, retired Navy Admiral James Stavridis joins us to break down the morning's top stories from overseas, including new signs that Russia's war in Ukraine won't be ending anytime soon. Way Too Early. We'll be right back with that. Iran has executed the first prisoner known to be convicted for an alleged crime stemming from ongoing nationwide protests there. According to an Iranian news agency, the man has been accused by the regime of blocking a street and attacking a security force member with a knife. Iran has been rocked by protests since September after 22-year-old Mahsa Amini died after being detained by the country's so-called morality police. Other detainees also face possible death penalties for their involvement in the protests. Other overseas news. In a sweeping day of political drama, Peru's president, Pedro Castillo, was impeached yesterday after attempting to dissolve the government and seize power. Protests broke out shortly after the country's Congress overwhelmingly voted to remove Castillo from office. By nightfall, he had been arrested and now faces charges of rebellion. The vice president, who replaces Castillo, was sworn into office yesterday. You're seeing her there. The 60-year-old lawyer becomes the first woman to lead the country in its roughly 200-year history. Turning now to the war in Ukraine, where Vladimir Putin's, quote, special military operation that was supposed to take mere days is nearing 10 full months. Yesterday, Putin warned Russian citizens to prepare for the war to drag on even longer. Speaking at a council meeting of journalists and public figures, Putin used the words long process to describe the nature of the war. The admission from the Russian president is a far cry from the Kremlin's rhetoric throughout the majority of the conflict. Putin also said that at this point, the Kremlin will not conscript more troops, adding that, quote, there is no need. Joining us now, retired four-star Navy Admiral James Stavridis. He is an NBC Chief International Analyst, as well NBC and MSNBC Chief International Analyst, as well as former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Admiral, you've got a lot of titles. Yesterday, Putin spoke about nuclear weapons, saying Russia is not crazy and the country is not going to brandish these weapons like a razor. We know from the start of this conflict there has been this worry that he would do the unthinkable. What do you make of his comments yesterday?
I think they're accurate as follows. We're not dealing with Mad King George with nuclear weapons here. Putin is, roughly speaking, a rational actor. He responds to stimulus, both carrots and stick, ultimately will have impact on Vladimir Putin. And I despise Vladimir Putin. I'm under sanctions from Vladimir Putin. Thank you very much. I'll take that title. But I'll give him this. As much as I despise him, I'll give him this. He loves his country. So he's not going to reach for the lever to the nuclear apocalypse. He knows that would destroy Russia, along with a lot of the rest of the world. Not going to happen. Could he use a tactical nuclear weapon? I think that's a very tiny possibility, Jonathan. But even there, if he does use a nuclear device, he is going to cause the big swing vote in the middle. And by that, I mean India, China, Brazil, Nigeria, South Africa. These are big, important countries that are kind of trying to play the ball down the middle. Putin uses a nuclear weapon. That herd is going to move to the West. It's going to move toward Ukraine. He knows that. So bottom line, I think his comments are accurate. I don't lay awake at night worrying that Putin's going to use a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, we should note that U.S. officials at no point during the conflict have noticed that Russia has escalated its nuclear status. But Putin did say the war is going to go on for quite some time, and it has certainly been exposed a lot of weaknesses in that country's military, including its air defense capability. There have been drone strikes in Russia this week sent from Ukraine. How is it possible that these drones have been able to travel dozens, hundreds of miles into Russian territory without being shot down first?
Exactly as you hypothesized, and you and I talked about this on Morning Joe, our sister show, yesterday. This long-range drone activity shows you that Russia doesn't have the kind of minute-to-minute, second-to-second control of its airspace the way, frankly, we do here in the United States because of NORAD, the North American Air Defense System, headquartered in Cheyenne in Colorado Springs. We know what's in the skies above the United States at all times. I'm not sure the Kremlin does. So that is a weakness. Is that going to be determinative in the war? Probably not. But symbolically, the chance for the Ukrainians to launch, conduct, and successfully destroy even a tiny bit of Russian military capability is quite important. Final thought, Jonathan. Let's make a point here. Ukraine has conducted a legitimate military attack against military targets inside Russia. What Russia is doing, carpet bombing, going after civilian infrastructure, that's a war crime. It's very different.
Right. Russia using drones to do so in recent weeks. And one of the targets Ukraine seems to have hit back in Russia, one of the places where those drones were being launched from. Admiral, before you go, let's turn back to Iran. We noted that the nation has reportedly executed the first prisoner known to be convicted for an alleged crime stemming from these protests, which have lasted months now. What is your expectation here? Are we going to see a shift in how that nation handles the protests? Is there going to be a further crackdown, or could this moment, this execution, actually stir more dissent moving forward?
I would say there are some Ayatollahs holding their breath right now, waiting to see what happens after this execution. And don't forget, earlier this week, Jonathan, we saw a tiny little crack, at least in the messaging, where one of the senior actors in the Iranian government said they were at least considering restraining these morality police, talking about whether the hijab, the headscarf, would continue to be required. You felt just a little bit of shaking under the foundation of that regime. This execution may be a demonstration in the other direction. We're going to have to wait and see over the next few days how this unfolds. Bottom line, the Iranian regime is in trouble here. I don't see it toppling in the immediate future, but this protest wave led by women and girls is quite remarkable historically. And it's a foretaste of the eventual outcome here. Eventually, that rotten regime is going to fall.
We're always so grateful for your analysis and hope to speak to you again soon. Former NATO Supreme Allied Commander James Savridis, thank you as always.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.